You're listening to Trail Mixed, an ecological show about art produced by the artist, pedestrian, and writer, Bram Thomas Arnold.
Discovery 4 computers now have primary control of critical vehicle functions. Computers now have primary control of critical vehicle functions.
Planning Matters was the title of a programme of events and talks curated and produced by Paul Cheney, Associate Artist of Kessel Barton Gallery on the Lizard in Cornwall, in the summer of 2019. The programme was produced to coincide with an exhibition of photographs by David Spiro entitled Settlements, which in turn is an ongoing photographic record of a small number of communities and individuals in Britain who are exploring alternative, land-based and low-impact ways of living. In this edition of Trail Mixed, we will journey through a series of lectures and talks that, as Cheney puts it in his programme introduction, encounter issues that emerge amidst notions of low-impact development, land ownership, planning law, and sustainable urban planning in these times of housing crisis, societal collapse, mass extinction, and potential transformation. Our three main protagonists are Dr. Tom Greaves, an archaeologist who went from working for Devon County Council to co-founding the Dartmoor Society, the writer, campaigner, and agriculturalist, Simon Fairley, who was co-editor of The Ecologist magazine for 4 years before joining an innovative community-owned farm in Dorset in 1994 and going on to co-found the off-grid community at Tinker's Bubble in Somerset. And Dr. Mike Hannis, currently senior lecturer in environmental humanities at Bath Spa University and an editor of The Land magazine, who lives off-grid and under canvas and has done so for the past 25 years.
My first home away from the childhood nest was a static caravan in the corner of a farmer's field in deepest Somerset. This was also my first experience of living without planning permission. For the following 20 years, I lived in an assortment of caravans, self-made shacks, small yachts on muddy creeks and wrecked boats on dry land. This unusual and inconvenient mode of living stemmed from self-imposed poverty. Being from a relatively poor family and wanting to dedicate my life to artistic practice, I had to find ways to live as cheaply as possible to follow the threads of my research. Luckily, this combined well with the desire to live a bit of a wild life among the wildlife, as it were. After years of living in a caravan in windy farmyard corners, as a lone resident of empty campsites in wintertime, or under canvas in hazel pole benders hidden among the meadows of friendly landowners, I was able to borrow a sum of money and buy a small piece of land myself. There, I explored self-sufficiency and off-grid living for 8 years, built myself a larger bender using an old army tarpaulin, and grew most of my own food. Living with no electricity or piped hot water gave me a certain amount of economic breathing space. According to British planning law, a person in England is allowed to use a piece of land they might own for so-called alternative uses for no more than 28 days of the year. This means if you own a piece of land without residential planning permission, you are only allowed to sleep there for 4 weeks of the year and for no more than 2 consecutive nights at a time. This fact had come as a surprise to me years previously when I was researching methodologies for achieving a low-impact life. Now, as a small-time landowner myself, I began to dance the merry jig one does with the planning system, to either submit and conform to its logic or duck under its radar and avoid its scrutiny. At any moment, I could have been served with a notice to evict from my own house on my own land. The more I prepared for that day, the more I began to perceive planning law as a legal instrument designed to fundamentally outlaw unconventional lives like mine. Sitting on the wrong side of the fence that demarcates the establishment, planning law looks very much like an instrument of control. It is an instrument whose roots can be traced back to the politics of the English Civil War and the wide-scale enclosure of the Commons, which we all know coincided with the rapid rise of capitalism and the development of the industrial model of urbanity. On the one hand, planning law preserves what is called in the planning trade the visual amenity of the countryside, the bucolic chocolate box fantasy of pastoral idyll to which we, the British, seem so attached. And on the other hand, it enshrines in law the alienating relationship between capital and labour that forces human subjects to work for the man rather than being able to exist on the land and simply live to provide for themselves. The capacity to live on the land and grow your own food is as close to emancipation from capitalism as is possible for the modern human to achieve. To exist on the land surviving from its fruits is to exist within the economy of the benevolent glowing orb, our contemporary sun, rather than an economy engineered by the extraction and capitalisation of a stratified and toxic solar past, a retrograde economy cynically based on the peddling of extravagant, addictive, and ultimately ecocidal products. With access to land, a person can be free from the alienating grind of capitalist techno-production. However, to avoid the rose-tinted glass here, we must admit that refusing the tyranny of capital reveals other long-forgotten tyrannies. The tyranny of corporeal fragility, the tyranny of climate, weather, insect, airborne pathogen, and the tyranny of the soil itself. But we will ignore these other tyrannies for now, because our focus here is planning law. Planning law props up time immemorial separations between the landed and the landless, to make sure that the have-nots never regain the means for self-provision, and whose labours therefore remain fodder for baronial estate, Tyneside mill or Amazon warehouse. Planning law point blank rejects the individual's choice to live akin to a traditional peasant in the UK. Those who might want to live an ecologically sustainable life on the land simply cannot unless they are substantially wealthy. As an artist, constantly battling to ring-fence sections of my time for creative thought and practice, these questions of labour sovereignty concern me greatly. As an ardent horticulturalist and naturephile, I was more than happy to personally remove the tyranny of capitalism from my life and replace it with the tyranny of the soil. For me, the issue of achieving personal autonomy from capital has now been surpassed by the more pressing issue of climate catastrophe and the mutual task of inventing a future that circumvents total anthropogenic ecocide. The same set of rules and laws that restrict access to personal land-based autonomy also restrict the possibilities for wide-scale transition to a functioning low-carbon, low-impact civilization. Strict zoning rules enforce the division between urban and rural. A red line is drawn around each town and city, keeping the rural as an empty zone, patrolled by 400 brake-horsepower tractors and wealthy downshifters, while poorer working-class urban populations buckle under the intense pressure of property speculation and buy-to-let schemes. This policy, while currently masqueraded as a device to keep the British hinterlands green and pretty, stems from the historical necessity of industry to have access to a disenfranchised and landless workforce. With the commons suitably enclosed, entire populations could be moved off the hills and put to work in the mill towns of Victorian England. This system of rigid separation of rural and urban requires a continual flow of intensely farmed products into the city centres. Zoning rules exist completely at odds to recent recommendations from the United Nations, the EU, and our very own Ministry of Agriculture, who state that our food system should be allowed to return to a more ecologically sound and economically robust system of decentralised small family-run farms, diverse agricultural micro-businesses, and localised supply chains. Supply chains that would require an increased rural population to provide a diversely skilled local workforce. In the face of our desperately uncertain future, the legal instrument used to define the practical relationships between the urban and the rural needs to be called up for a review. At the very least, to allow more experimentation with alternative models of master planning, to encourage localised food sovereignty and economic systems based on small-scale local production and consumption of natural goods. The Planning Matters programme I have been asked to curate at Kettle, Bath and Gallery here in Cornwall has been an opportunity for me to pull together a dream team of thinkers, activists and artists who have all been concerned with these themes. Together, we will try and draw out some important questions. For example, who is planning law actually for? What are its origins and why was it written into law in the first place? How does it affect how we occupy the landscape, how rural communities are formed and how they interact with each other? What is the psychology behind NIMBYism? How were people on the one hand able to advocate for ecological ideals, but on the other, write stiff letters of complaint when a windmill is proposed nearby? What is visual amenity? Why do we protect the rights of those who gaze on landscapes over the rights of people who would try and make a living in them? Is the way the countryside looks more important than how people function within it? We know that the planning system is a postcode lottery, classist and optimised for big business. If Quadrilla want to drill, they will eventually drill. If Amazon want to build a 5-hectare warehouse, they will build it. If global corporations want to build hypermarkets outside every market town, destroying localised agricultural production, food sovereignty and local distinctiveness forever, they will be allowed to do it. Oh look, they already did. Whereas a young couple wanting to live sustainably on the land to provide a livelihood for themselves and build themselves an ecological cabin to live in won't be allowed. This triggers further questions. What is the relationship between planning law and power? What is betterment? How does it generate capital from development? How does planning law function to deny the working classes access to land? And even more broadly, what does development mean in the context of the climate catastrophe? Taking David Spiro's exhibition of photographs as a starting point, we will try and imagine what would happen if low-impact living principles were to be regularised and scaled up. We will try and think speculatively about what happens when the current model of urbanity becomes so pressurised by the climate catastrophe that it ruptures and urban populations flood out into the rural. Already the notion of moving out of the city to make new sustainable lives on the land is becoming more and more popular. Shouldn't the planning system be preempting that and supporting the way people want to live, while actually taking real measures to protect ecological systems and the vitality of the landscape? For me, planning law represents a blunt instrument wielded in the hands of a chosen few. The ecologically minded precariat depicted in Spiro's photographs, who attempted to live in mutualism with the planetary biota and its metabolic systems at Steward Wood, not only sit on the front line of planning law, but also on the front line of a potentially sustainable future for us all.
Thank you. Great. Well, we have wonderful photographs of David Spiro's on the wall beside me here, and some 50 pages of photographs and text in his wonderful book, Settlements, evoke the experience of the community who lived in Steward Wood on Dartmoor from 2000 to 2018. This evening I want to remind you of the bare bones of the planning story and to explore and question why their project became a victim of a particular planning mindset within a national park, which we might perhaps have expected to behave very differently. There are messages for all of us in this time of climate emergency, including some surprising ones about the role of national parks in the year when the 70th anniversary of the passing of national park legislation in England and Wales is being marked. My interest is that of a cultural environmentalist. All my adult life, I've been interested in people who have lived and worked on Dartmoor for millennia.
Dartmoor, a misty, barren granite cap of rock and bog some 30 miles across, that has escaped wholesale destruction, partly because no road crossed it until 200 years ago. Its heights were farmed only briefly between the 11th and 14th centuries, and today only the dedicated plunge into its interior.
I am trained as an archaeologist and historian, but have always recognised that it's one's own time that is the most interesting of all. Steward Wood is situated on the northeastern side of Dartmoor. It lies in the Ray Valley, an earthquake fault line. Geologically, it is part of the granite massif of Dartmoor. Stewart Wood is at the northern end of a more or less continuous zone of semi-natural ancient woodland, but it does not itself fall into this category. The site takes its name from historic Stewart Wood Farm, of which no visible trace now remains, except for the former fields on which the woodland has been created. 32 acres of woodland are owned by the Affinity Woodland Workers Cooperative, which created Stewart Community Woodland. The woodland on the historic farmland was once owned by the progressive and radical Dartington estate.
Because of course I had heard of Dartington. Who hadn't? People had been saying saucy things about that place for a long time. As an outsider, I myself had merely picked up some of the funny stories about the school, where the children were said to be allowed to do anything they liked.
Which itself explored new covenants and relationships with the land, and which created an experimental coniferous plantation on the site from the 1930s to the 1960s. It is now defined as woodland of conservation importance under the Wildlife and Countryside Amendment Act 1985, Section 3. The community of 10 adults moved onto the site in April 2000, empowered by a permaculture ethos. Very soon, Dartmoor National Park Authority was alerted to their presence, and in July 2000 authorised legal action to bring this use of the land to an end. The community simultaneously applied retrospectively for, quote, low-impact, sustainable development associated with agriculture and forestry enterprise, incorporating educational and residential elements. In November 2000, this application was refused on the grounds that, quote, the proposed residential use of the land would constitute an unjustified form of development in the open countryside, which would detract from the character and appearance of this part of Dartmoor National Park, unquote. This phrase will reemerge.
My travels are through. Let's move to the country, just me and you.
Dartmoor National Park Authority once again refused the application, arguing that the community had not fulfilled the targets of what they had said they would achieve. Astonishingly, the planners stated in their committee report that, quote, most of the occupants' time was spent merely surviving, and they had little time or energy to do anything else, unquote. The reasons for refusal included that it was unjustified form of development in the open countryside, which would, quote, be detrimental to the character and appearance of this part of the Dartmoor National Park. The community appealed against this refusal, and a public inquiry was held over 3 days in April 2009. For a second time, a planning inspector overturned the decision of Dartmoor National Park Authority, allowing the appeal and granting the community a further temporary planning permission for another 5 years until June 2014. The inspector concluded that the value of the project is its holistic nature.
Stewart Wood. Rediscovering the art of community, of cooperation and sharing, is the foundation of how we go forward as humanity. It is only by living together in harmony that we can find and implement solutions to the environmental challenges of our times. This is a journey from a competitive, individualistic, materialistic and youth-centered dominant culture to a rediscovery and embodiment of the ideals of love, cooperation, sharing and mutual respect. It is finding the right balance between total communal living and the nuclear family. To this end, each family and household at Steward Wood has its separate dwelling and family life, while we share communal facilities and come together often to discuss, work, eat and play. We share our skills while valuing our unique talents and gifts. We are both empowered individuals and dependent on each other. In short, the community is greater than the sum of its parts.
The authority had by this time a vision of sustainable development, derived from a UK government sustainable development strategy, which recognises that the three pillars of the economy, society and the environment are interconnected, and that this is achieved by stimulating economic growth, maximising well-being and protecting the environment without negatively impacting on the ability of future generations to do likewise. Paul Freer, the planning inspector, announced his decision in August 2016, dismissing the appeal. Paul Freer's decision required that 12 adults and 9 children would have to leave their homes by August 2017. Reluctantly, by March 2018, the community announced that most of the residents had left and that their homes and ancillary structures were being dismantled. An overemphasis on natural beauty, enshrined in national parks legislation, stems ultimately from the romantics of 200 years ago.
5 years have passed, 5 summers with the length of 5 long winters, and again I hear these waters rolling from their mountain springs with a sweet inland murmur. Once again do I behold these steep and lofty cliffs, which on the wild secluded scene impress thoughts of more deep seclusion and connect the landscape with the quiet of the sky. The day has come when I again repose here under this dark sycamore and view these plots of cottage ground, these orchard tufts, which at this season with their unripe fruits among the woods and copses lose themselves, nor with their green and simple hue disturb the wild green landscape. Once again I see these hedgerows, hardly hedgerows, little lines of sportive wood run wild, these pastoral farms green to the very door, and wreaths of smoke sent up in silence from among the trees, with some uncertain notice, as might seem, of vagrant dwellers in the houseless woods, or of some hermit's cave where by his fire the hermit sits alone.
This notion has been, in my opinion, one of the main flaws in the conservation movement of post-war Britain. It is an imprecise term, in that all of the British landscape has been influenced to a greater or lesser extent by human activity, and in the uplands especially, by the management of grazing animals over millennia. The natural environment is dominant in all conservation policy making, to the detriment of understanding and protecting the cultural environment, which should be in equal balance with it. I believe the Steward Wood planning decision also arose partly from a residual or subliminal perception of a requirement for a national park to be neat and tidy. The very first Dartmoor National Park plan of 1977 identified a central theme of achieving, and I quote, a national park which is as tidy, enjoyable and uncontentious as possible.
Thank you.
So, in summary, Dartmoor National Park and Mr. Freer, the planning inspector, badly misjudged Stuart Wood and failed to recognise what a life-enhancing environmental and cultural project it was. Mr. Freer's arbitrary dismissal of massive local support is scandalous. They should have welcomed this courageous community into the Dartmoor ambit, seeking ways of working with them and adapting their policies to fit this exemplar of how some people might live within Dartmoor now and in the future. Dartmoor clearly has the space to accommodate such dedicated small groups of people. The population of Stuart Wood represent 0.06% of the population of the National Park. The National Park Authority should have encouraged other environmentally aware pioneers so that Dartmoor would be seen as genuinely leading the way for a better future, for balanced nature and culture, constantly promoting and debating new ideas and projects. Fortunately, we have David Spiro's photographs, both as a record of what that community achieved and as an inspiration for others to follow. Thank you.
Joining the intentional community at Tinker's Bubble in 1994 in Somerset. Tinker's Bubble was where a unique planning amendment was agreed with the local council to allow the community members to establish one of the first low-impact eco-villages in the UK. He now runs Chapter 7, an organisation and lobby group that provides planning advice to smallholders and other people attempting to live sustainably on the land in the UK. He's co-editor of The Land magazine and author of Low Impact Development, Planning and People in a Sustainable Countryside, published by John Carpenter, and Meet, a Benign Extravagance, published by Chelsea Green. So Simon's talk is entitled A Short History of Enclosure in Britain, and he's going to introduce us to the political origins of the modern land ownership pattern in the UK and the planning system.
Okay, thank you. Right, so I hope that this will work fluidly. I'm going to click my fingers every time you've got me. If we can shut the door a bit, that would be really helpful. After leaving. Yeah, that's fine. This talk is based around an article that was published in 2009 in the Land magazine called A Short History of Enclosure. I read it yesterday and I thought it was quite good. Which in fact picks up on something that Paul said yesterday, for those who were here yesterday, was that you look out beyond this place to the wheat fields that are out there and there's nobody in them, which he said was a big contrast to, where was it you were talking about? In the Andes, yes, and it's the same in India and in fact throughout most of the world. If you go into the countryside, you'll see people in the fields. but it's quite unusual to see somebody in a field in Britain these days. You might see a tractor with somebody in it, and soon there won't be anybody in the tractors either. The corollary of the emptiness of the English countryside is the fullness of English towns. And this is an LCC block in about the 1950s. Britain, more than any other European country, and more than any country, I suppose it's places like Hong Kong and Singapore, has funneled the majority of citizens into towns and emptied the countryside. The countryside, that's a Bruegel picture that many of you will recognise of harvest, and the countryside was once teeming with people. Especially at certain times of year. So you can see there's people working here, there's people eating here, there's people trotting up the road, and over there there's more of them doing something in the fields over there. that's what the countryside was like for a large part of, for most of history. What happens next? This is an aerial view of the open fields, and it involved strips. All these are strips that were ploughed. The open field system basically relied on people having access to a certain amount of ground for cultivation within a collective ecosystem. Each person had their own private bit of a collective system, and the collective system included the arable land, which you can see here, but it would also include pasture and waste, and it would include commons that had other commodities on them, like timber. And it really was a reflection of what was necessary at the time. Partly it was the result of the introduction of the carucha, which was a kind of plough. Up until about the Norman Conquest, the main plough was the arrear, which was a single furrow, small plough. The carucha was a much more powerful plough, but it required a big oxen team, and on heavy clay it required up to 6 or even 8 oxen, and most peasants didn't have that. So it required a collective use of the ploughing system as well. And that was one of the main reasons why the common field system developed. And it's important to understand that this system was widely used and still is used in many places all over Europe and in parts of Africa, in parts of Asia and so forth, because it was a logical system which allowed everybody access to their own individual plot within a collective system. So the land was probably owned by the lord of the manor or some big cheese, but in those days, up until the enclosure that we're coming to, land ownership wasn't something absolute. If you owned the land, you didn't automatically have all the rights to it, and other people had various different rights to do various things.
In 1890, the pioneering psychologist William James speculated that the urge to possess was intrinsic to human nature. We feel and act about certain things that are ours very much as we feel and act about ourselves, he wrote. Our fame, our children, The work of our hands may be as dear to us as our bodies are, and arouse the same feelings and the same acts of reprisal if attacked. It was not so much a materialist or acquisitive desire as an elemental urge for attachment, a blind impulse, as he put it, that embraced both people and objects. Everything that could have the adjective my in front of it. Parents, spouses, children, clothes, jewellery, homes. Strengthened the inner sense of identity by offering external evidence of who a person really was. And, James added, an equally instinctive impulse drives us to collect property, and the collections thus made become, with different degrees of intimacy, parts of our empirical selves.
Now, my favourite example of the way in which the common... Well, basically, the private interests and common interests moved backwards and forwards was in... And it's just best described, actually, in Daniel Defoe's book of his travels
in the
around Britain.
Country. On the other side of the Mendip Hills lies Cheddar, a village pleasantly situated under the very ridge of the mountains. Before the village is a large green, or common, a piece of ground in which the whole herd of the cows belonging to the town do feed. The ground is exceeding rich, and as the whole village are cow keepers, they take care to keep up the goodness of the soil by agreeing to lay on large quantities of dung for manuring and enriching the land. The milk of all the town cows is brought together every day into a common room where the persons appointed or trusted for the management measure every man's quantity and set it down in a book. When the quantities are adjusted, the milk is all put together, and every meal's milk.
That was a collective procedure because there was an obvious economy of scale in having only one person look after everybody's cows. Now we come to the sort of enclosure bit, which is, and this is a wool dealer, you know, a medieval wool dealer, and these are sacks of wool. And the first onslaught against the commons and common management of land it can be dated to 1235, which is the Statute of Merton, which made it considerably easier for landowners to privatise their land, basically for sheep. Wool was the first sort of capitalist commodity in Britain. The advantage for landowners was that if you had a load of families on your land, then they had to be fed. So although they were producing more, the actual profit at the end of it was less. Whereas if you got rid of all the people and you put sheep on, the sheep were much less productive than corn and dairy. But all the profit went to the landowner.
This is Thomas Moore writing in Utopia in Henry VIII's reign. Your sheep that were wont to be so meek and tame and so small eaters, now, as I hear say, become so great devourers and so wild that they eat up and swallow down the very men themselves. They consume, destroy, and devour whole fields, houses, and cities. Noblemen and gentlemen, yea, and certain abbots, leave no ground for tillage. They enclose all into their pastures. They throw down houses, they pluck down towns, and leave nothing standing, but only the church to be made a sheep house. Hark, hark, the dogs do bark, the beggars are coming to town. That's a nursery rhyme that dates from that era when thousands of displaced people were literally let loose on the streets of the country begging. But all of this process was not without resistance. In fact, the whole history... social history of England is just full of resistance.
In a campaign speech in 1906, Winston Churchill explained the essential difference in a fine rolling phrase. Land, which is a necessity of all human existence, which is the original source of all wealth, which is strictly limited in extent, which is fixed in geographical position. Land, I say, differs from all other forms of property in these primary and fundamental conditions. Consequently, unlike a hoe or an iPad, which can be carried, is available by the million and so can be owned without depriving anyone else of its benefits, the way you own the earth requires the agreement of your neighbours, the society you live in, and the government of your country. In a very fundamental way, it is the glue that holds a community together, and every society agrees that it cannot, in fact, be owned.
By 1935, there was one worker for every 12 hectares in the UK, compared to one worker for every 4.5 hectares in France, and one for every 3.4 hectares across the whole of Europe. That was the level of rural depopulation that was taking place. 100 years ago, they were spending more on food than they were on, considerably more on food than they were on lodging. Now they're spending considerably more on their lodging than they are on their food. And that's reflected in this, where everybody's crammed into these little pocket bits of land here that they're paying, they spend half their life paying off for that. And here you've got all this land which nobody has access to except one man and his tractor and his poisons and his chemicals. And that's what enclosure has given us. It's given us a world in which the majority of people have no connection with the countryside at all. And it's something we're beginning to realise has to be addressed.
For the next segment, I mean, effectively, this is our keynote speaker today, Dr. Mike Hannis. Mike Hannis is Senior Lecturer in Environmental Humanities at Bath Spa University and an editor of The Land magazine. He has lived off-grid under canvas for 25 years in Kings Hill in Somerset, a low-impact settlement which gained permanent planning permission in 2000 after lengthy legal wrangling. Over to you, Mike. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Paul, and thanks very much for inviting me, and thanks everybody for being here. It's slightly different audience to what I'm perhaps used to, but I'll try to. There will inevitably be some of those long words which have already cropped up, you know. But I try not to do too much of a sort of academic-y presentation. But I mean, you know, as Paul said, being an academic is only one of my sort of hats, you know. Another one is that I have been living in structures like what David has so beautifully documented for a long time, and I've also been involved in planning consultancy, helping other people, including some of those people, in their struggles with the planning authorities over that period. You've all seen the exhibition and maybe even read bits of the book and other sort of related stuff. And so you'd be familiar with this kind of framing of land use planning as a kind of enemy of low impact development, this kind of top down, bureaucratic, intrusive system coming in as the kind of like the personification of the authoritative state that, you know, many people with these kind of lifestyles have spent their life trying to get away from that. Connected with that is this idea that the planning system enforces a depopulated landscape. I want to sort of talk about a few other concepts of planning. One is, of course, the planning legislation that we live with in this country was brought in after the Second World War as part of the kind of, you know, it came in at the same time as the National Health Service and the 1944 Education Act and all that sort of stuff. It was actually part of that post-war idealism, and it was sometimes framed as nationalising the right to development. I think it is fair to say planning is kind of an inherently socialist concept, which is why Tories are always uncomfortable with it, you know. It's basically about, yes, you may own that bit of land, but that doesn't mean it's like some sort of absolute kingdom. So, and one of the things that was represented in this in the original legislation, which was then battled backwards and forwards over the next several administrations, was this idea of capturing betterment value. And betterment basically means the increase in the value of a piece of land that accrues when you get planning permission on it to do something. So, you know, I own a farm on the edge of an expanding town. My land is worth £1 million. I get planning permission to build 100 houses on it. It's now worth several £1 million overnight, very quickly. Well, the 1947 Act actually said, well, no, that's not your money. That increase in value is captured and accrues to the public purse, thereby discouraging speculation in land and discouraging the gaming of planning and zoning decisions. And this was a very radical idea, yeah, which is exactly why the next Tory administration ditched it. And then the Labour one after that tried to bring it back, and then the Tory one after that finally got rid of it. Yeah. So we don't have that, but that was part of the spirit of the 1947 Act. But there was a strong sort of air of egalitarian, redistributive, utopian thinking in planning as conceived in this way of looking at it, right? You're still imposing a rationality, but like, arguably, you're imposing a rationality of the common good as it is perceived by the state, at least in that moment. We could go back in history a little bit. Picture's complicated again, because actually there are some beautiful work being done showing how the whole of the modern planning system in many ways actually is rooted in colonialism. It's rooted in the sort of grabbing of terra nullius in places like Australia, and then it's erasing the indigenous dwelling practices and sort of facilitating control over both the landscape and whatever people are already there. And critically, creating property rights in this land, carving it all up. Andrew Linklater's book, Owning the Earth, goes into this in great detail.
The disruption of this pattern is the great revolution of the last 200 years. The idea of individual exclusive ownership, not just of what can be carried or occupied, but of the immovable, near-eternal earth, has proved to be the most destructive and creative cultural force in written history. It has eliminated ancient civilizations wherever it has encountered them, and displaced entire peoples from their homeland. But it has also spread an undreamed-of degree of personal freedom, and protected it with democratic institutions wherever it has taken hold.
That's really good stuff. So here we're imposing the rationality of the colonising power on the colonised land and the colonised people. And, You know, now we're back to a kind of like very negative view of planning. You know, God, is this really what it's doing? Well, that's terrible, you know. So another negative one. Well, you know, and this is kind of stuff that is very much involved in that first perception that we saw from the low impact people, is planning as sort of capitalist neoliberalism, mobilizing everything to produce economic growth via profitable private business. Land is capital, nature is capital. There's a paradox about this version, though, which is that actually it tends to go with a very strong discourse of anti-planning, anti-regulation, freeing people to do whatever they want with their property. So there's all these different versions of what planning does or could do, you know. And then we come to this kind of master frame, which is now what's used. Oh, well, planning is actually, you know, if you look on page one of most plans, or bits of planning legislation, or indeed papers about planning, it'll tell you it's all about achieving sustainable development. And, you know, because, like, what are we sustaining exactly? Why? Who for? What is development anyway? No poverty, zero hunger, good health and well-being, quality education, gender equality, clean water and sanitation, affordable and clean energy, decent work and economic growth. That's a bit of an interesting one. Industry, innovation and infrastructure, reduced inequality, sustainable cities and communities, responsible consumption and production, climate action, life below water, life on land, peace, justice and strong institutions, and partnerships. So, is anybody any the wiser? Whatever it is, this weird sustainable development thing, it does require that those who are more affluent adopt lifestyles within the planet's ecological means. And then it goes back into lots of fudge. But what exactly are needs? Well, you know, often they're reinterpreted as desires or as preferences. But so what are we trying to sustain? What are we trying to sustain? You'd be familiar with the sort of Extinction Rebellion discourse at the moment, that actually, oh well, you know, lots of things and lots of species are going extinct, and we might even be next, you know. So what we need to sustain is all the species that currently exist, and indeed us. And this is a quote from an Indian writer in the early 90s, quite shortly after that Brundtland report came out, and saying, well, sustainable and development they belong to different incommensurable worlds, he says. Sustainability is about care and concern. Development is a genocidal act of control. A contract between the modern nation state and modern Western science. And as part of this, nature and the non-human world becomes seen as a commodity. And not just the commodities like, you know, iron ore that you might dig up, not just commodities like wheat that you might grow, but also like the commodity of nature in which you might go out for recreational, spiritual fulfillment. That also becomes a commodity as part of this process. So subsistence lifestyles are discouraged, humans separated from non-human, nature becomes an other to be both exploited and desired. And so there is this assumption that human presence is detrimental to whatever nature we might be trying to preserve. Let's go back then now to development in UK planning. This might seem like a bit of a leap, but okay, so we've kind of problematised the whole concept. Development, what does it mean? Well, okay, in UK planning law, well, English planning law specifically, different in Scotland, but not that different, but this is the definition. Carrying out building, engineering, mining or other operations in, on, over or under land, or the making of any material change in the use of any buildings or other land. Hopefully we can sort of see that the kind of conceptual roots of that sort of strange edifice of English planning law that feels itself bound to refuse permission to all these harmless characters trying to live in their shacks, you know. This is what it's all about, you know. It's the argument that you're not doing any harm doesn't cut any ice, because, you know, actually you are doing harm by sort of transgressing these conceptual structures. There's a context to all this, isn't there? You know, this is not happening despite what either side of these debates may say, it's not happening in isolation. It's happening within the kind of modern social context, and you know, in which there is, of course, a massive housing affordability crisis due to property being, speculated upon in a capitalist market. You know, there's something about the repression of subsistence agriculture that kind of goes along with the repression of lifestyles in which one is sort of attempting to provide for oneself in ways that don't involve continually being knocked back from an economy that one is not able to find a niche in, you know. So I think, I think it's possible to have a planning system that's not the enemy of low-impact development, but, you know, while it's a planning system serving economic growth and a planning system that sees land as a commodity to speculate on, we're never going to get past it, you know. But the answer to those problems is not to say that planning is the enemy, because actually solving the problems that we're all concerned about does require a lot of planning. I think I'll stop there. Thanks. Thank you.
Wow. That's going to take some processing.
Fortunately, you recorded it.
Yeah.
Move to the country. Let's move to the country. Just you and me. My travels are over. My travels are room. Let's move to the country, just me and you.
Trail Mixed is produced by the artist, pedestrian and writer Ram Thomas Arnold. For more information, see www.ramthomasarnold.com.